call everybody in, or just close the door. And those who are outside must never return. Make our job easy. Okay, the next presentation, I'm told, is going to be made by Fedusa Submission. I hope you've been informed in that it's not an ambush. You know that you're the next Fedusa. Who's Fedusa here?
Yesterday we had candlemas, today we are delighted.
I was looking at the prof, I said maybe he has moved on, now it's now his producer. Okay. Thank you. You're welcome. I think my coach has done the normal welcoming and all these things before, so we just proceed. It's a familiar terrain. It's not a new terrain that you need to be taken through. You've been here before, you understand us, and we think we understand. Always, as we say, value your contributions, all of you. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. We're all women team today. So we're focusing on the equity issues quite a lot in our budget speech, and therefore we thought it's appropriate to also have our social policy officer here to deal with some of the issues. The budget submission on producer's side is going to focus on a couple of issues. We've got a long, lengthy submission, which is a lot more detailed document that's supplied to you, and then we've got the PowerPoint, which is short because of the time constraints, which is going to focus on the PowerPoint for the time being. We've just come out of one of the worst recessions since the Great Depression. The focus on the budget is specifically on the need to establish a new growth plan. It's focusing on infrastructure development to get us back on the path of recovery and to deal with the key challenges in the South African economy. The spirit of Ubuntu and active citizenry is in the budget, and it's extending it to all citizens to play a major role in terms of the macroeconomic change, to look at stability, sustainability, and to us that's quite positive. As a whole, the budget is focusing on creating jobs, building partnerships, addressing poverty, and expanding the economy. It's also become clear in terms of economic reports that South Africa has been extended to a greater extent than we've previously thought, and that it affected us quite major. In terms, if you look at the World Economic Outlook of January 2012 of the IMF, South Africa was worse affected than most of the other sub-Saharan African countries due to our exposure to international markets and countries where the crisis originated. So this will focus specifically on the effects of the budget, or the deep recession on the budget, our new policies to overcome some of these socio-economic problems, the fiscal framework, and then we'll focus specifically on expenditure and tax measures around the budget dealing with some of these aspects. In terms of the global impact of recession, table one is on our document, in our deep document, our condensed document. In the slide, doesn't refer to table one, but table one is in the submission, page four of the submission itself. And on page four, it clearly indicates in the graph from the World Economic Forum what the impact of the recession has been on some of the economies and what the growth path should be for the next couple of years, and it shows the severity of the recession. We look at employment and inflation, not a very good picture out there for the next up to 2014. There's expected to be an increase. It's not within the growth figures that we want between the 3-6%. It's going to be on 3.1 in 2012, 2.7 in 2012, and then 4.2 by 2011, clearly indicating that there's we need a 6% growth rate in order to create the amount of jobs that we need to do, and we're still not able to deal with unemployment as we should. In our discussion, Fedusa makes specific proposals in terms of the job in unemployment, and we've got some provisions that we're making comments on the youth unemployment and youth wage subsidy. The document is available on the website, producer's website, and we've engaged with Treasury and Department of Labor quite a bit on the youth wage subsidy. The government forecast is that price inflation to rise from average of 5% in 2011 to 6.2% in 2012, and thereafter it's going to be declining, dependent also on the outlook of international markets and how that's going to affect us. Given the rise in the international price of oil, we are actually very concerned as producers that the inflation could probably be higher and it remain longer outside the inflation target of 3 to 6% due to commodities, etc., that's got an impact on our economy. If we look at infrastructure, the jobless growth, the high unemployment with the unequal distribution and poverty is one of South Africa's most serious challenges, and we need to address this in order for our economy to grow. Despite success with the other broad goals of economic policy, such as growth and inflation, the balance of payments, we need to focus on socio-economic strategies, the RDP GEAR, its GISA, and job creation is always the central theme of some of these policies. Now with the new growth path policy that we've been intricately involved in, it's a focus of the National Planning Commission to overcome some of these challenges. Where the budget concentrated on job creation last year, this year the budget's focus is on infrastructure development as a core and also as one of the major drivers for job creation. In terms of the National Development Plan, it deals with socioeconomic policies, it identifies income equality, unemployment, poor quality of education, poorly located and insufficient infrastructure. The resource intensity of exports and the skewed spatial patterns are some of the major challenges within the economy. We met with the chairperson of the National Planning Commission in November 2011, and we will make formal proposals during March 2012 on the National Development Plan. We will also be presenting some comments to Parliament in terms of the National Planning Commission. It's very clear that there's a role to play both by the private sector, government, and all social partners. For the first time in the budget, it's actually acknowledged. We also engaged with the Minister of Finance a week prior to the budget being presented in Parliament on key aspects of the budget at NEDLAC in the NEDLAC Development Chamber to specifically focus on what is required to ensure that we've got growth. Producers agree with the shift in expenditure with a clear focus on infrastructure investment. There's high levels of public and private investment in economic and social infrastructure, and it will ensure that there's growth, GDP growth, rising employment, and per capita income, and most probably a broadening of your economic activity. We would require further details in terms of how the infrastructure is going to be financed, what are the roles of the different institutions that need to provide the finance. It's not clearly spelled out in the budget review or in the expenditure programs. One also need to look that there is currently consultation with social partners at NEDLAC to look at budget impacts and financing arrangements. Specifically, we need more consultation on key infrastructure spending programs with key captains of industry that are represented the social partners at NEDLAC. There's an all-inclusive approach, and we agree with this, and we would urge government to make sure that all these plans are converted into action. The budget emphasized the role of the private sector investment in building economic sustainability, and we concur with that. In terms of budget expenditure measures, there's target job creation programs into place, and we welcome the steps to increase jobs. However, one needs to look at some of the programs, your expanded public works programs, community work programs, working for water, working on fire, and the National Rural Youth Service Corps that are receiving more jobs. Some of these jobs, however, and I can concur with some of the statements by earlier presenters, that a lot of it is not long-term jobs. We need long-term jobs that can sustain our economy, not just short-term jobs that are linked to a project for a very short specific time. That's one of the problems that we're experiencing with the expanded public works program, that it's short-term jobs for a period of 2 to 3 months, comes to an end, and then people become unemployed again. In a recession, it's normally the poor that suffers the most, and we welcome the increase in the grants of the poor. However, in South Africa, as a development state, we need to ensure that the dependency rate is addressed in some way or other through various policies. The minister, in his budget speech last year, focused on the basic reason for the high dependency rate, and one of them are that citizens don't belong to a medical or retirement scheme, and to bring more people into the system through the NHI and medical insurances. We've made specific comments on the NHI and the retirement reform, and quite a lot of detail with the proposals. In our focus on tax proposals as contained in the 2012 budget, we didn't focus on all the tax proposals, we just focused on the amendments that are important. I think with tax, some will pay more, some will pay less. The changes will also affect us differently. I represent workers, I don't represent unemployed, we represent workers in the country. So our focus for the budget is specifically on what's the impact on workers. It depends on how much you receive of your salary every month. It depends on how you pay for certain things like VAT and SIN taxes, and also how much you need to pay when you sell certain assets and capital gains. We welcome the overall personal income relief of $9.5 billion. The bulk of this will go to lower income earners. A little bit concerned about retirement provisions still. Producer would have liked to see a stronger correlation here with the thrust in the budget to create a savings culture to prevent the major dependency on old age pensions, and specifically more relief to those in the age group 65 to 75 would have been maybe a very good stance. In terms of the tax treatment of medical expenses, as of 1st of March 2012, tax credits or medical aid contributions will be introduced to a tax credit, and major changes will be made in the system. We haven't seen the actual document or details of that, and we would just like to compare that. Our concern still remains with our older people. 65 years and older, and people with disabilities, what the impact of the so-called tax credits will be on them. A lot of them are dependent on the current tax treatment of medical expenses and do their planning on that basis. And for many of them, it might imply a tax increase, and we need more clarification from Treasury in that regard in terms of what exactly the impact is. A discussion document on the tax credits will be published by March 2012, and we will reserve our right to comment with the publication of the discussion document. Retirement funding and savings, I think this committee has heard me over the last 5 years continually speaking about retirement funds. Our members of trade unions, most of them belong to pension funds or some other sort of nature of making provision for retirement, and therefore it's got an impact on them, and we need to raise the issue. For the past 3 years, we have been calling for a discussion document to contextualize further retirement reform, introducing to encourage voluntary savings, for example. Consideration is currently focusing on the introduction of a tax-exempt short- and medium-term savings product. We would like the opportunity to increase the voluntary savings, but believe it should be subjected to a thorough consultative process within the NEDLAC domain for all social partners. Many South Africans leave their retirement too late. An additional amount will assist South Africa to deal with the shortfall. Through the IRS, a lot of discussions have taken place of the pension fund administrators, for example, that these deductions will be limited to a maximum amount of $250 for people younger than 45, and $300,000 for people older than 45. There's some proposals in the budget to speed the right retirement reform to assist individuals to be able to make provision for that. However, a lot of it needs to be finalized. It's about high time that we start finalizing the retirement reform. It's clearly linked to the social security reform process, but it's now the time to deal with that because we need to make provision for our old age pensioners as such. A major issue in retirement funds is the issue pertaining to preservation. Social partners need to consider ways to limit people to have the ability, people's ability to draw money from the retirement savings. It's a major issue. I'll take a point and example. When the minister, it was Minister Trevor Manuel, as finance minister, when he first indicated the Treasury will be looking at that, we had a major problem with the Transnet, for example, where employees were merely resigning to get access to the pension fund. Within 3 or 4 months, back at Transnet, but they've got their lump sums and they've taken the money out. Those are the type of examples that we need to prevent because in old age, those people will be the people that are depending on state money as retirement and pension, for example. So we need to start doing something that's a compulsory contribution list. We applaud the Minister for clear direction, but would favour to achieve a tax-free retirement environment in the future, because we need to make provision. We cannot keep on taxing people that are actually making provision for the retirement and not being dependent on the state. In terms of retirement funding and savings, there's some figures from Sanlam that showed that 20% of people indicate that they withdraw their retirement saving when they leave a job or move to another employer. A lot of them also do that when they go through divorce, then they draw some of their money to ensure that the divorce decree is taken through. Proper consultation needs to take place, and fiduciaries view with the different affiliates in different sectors may differ slightly, but the overall view is that you must not be able to take out at least two-thirds of your retirement savings out of your pension fund. There's no concrete solutions in terms of the monitoring and governance of pension funds. It's been something that's been muted. We look at the series of fraud and corruption cases last year alone. We look at the Saxo case, Richard Cowie case. Those are issues that we need to prevent. And those are issues that we need to deal with trustee training. We've been calling for this. The Minister of Finance has alluded to this in the last couple of years as well, but we haven't seen concrete proposals dealing with trustee training and dealing with the fraud in that sector. It's huge amounts of money that are subjected to fraudulent activities in some cases. Trustee education and communication with the pension sector did not receive mention in the budget. We've identified this as one of the critical issues needing to be addressed given the changes in the economic landscape, and we need to touch governance and proper accountability guidelines in that sector. A lot of has been done by the FSB and also by the Institute of Retirement Funds, but we need to do more. To encourage South Africans to save for retirement, contributions by employers and employers to pension, provident and retirement funds should be tax deductible. In terms of dividends tax, I'm not going to speak about the detail of that tax. I think to us the question just arises whether the tax treatment of dividends is in line with other countries at the same stage of development as South Africa and what the impact of that will be. The tax is not applicable to retirement funds. However, individual savings and equity investments will result in slightly slower or lower dividend returns. We welcome the provision, but we are concerned about the impact on retirement funds because retirement funds do make investments, and we need to look at that impact. In terms of CGT, when it was introduced in October 2012, it was a way of broadening the base. Our concern is the section that we've got in blue there. Though we agree with the tax fairness of all incomes, it should be included under the tax umbrella. The increase at this stage comes at a very unfortunate stage when the original or the ordinary citizen find it difficult to survive. There are measures to mitigate the effect on middle-income earners with the caps that have been increased, for example. It does not do enough to mitigate the whole effect. For some people, buying their property or their house is their only source of investment, for example, and making provision for retirement. And now we once again taxing that and we're increasing that. So that has an impact on retirement provision, for example. We welcome the relief for small businesses. In our previous comments from 2004 up to 2011, we've also said that there should be more favorable tax treatment for small businesses. Small business is the engine driver to create jobs, and we cannot overlook that. We are pleased with the different steps announced in the budget this year. Also, the qualifying micro-business turnover tax that's included, and also the measures dealing with the red tape where they only need to submit their tax returns twice a year. This will definitely ensure that the system of job creation within the small businesses are extended. In terms of the levy on the electricity, we will monitor this levy and alert for any concerns as soon as it arises in terms of the initiatives such as solar water geyser impact and what the tariffs on the levy on the man on the street at the end of the day will be is what we will be concerned about. General levy on petrol and diesel. Now, with the increase of from 4th of April of the road and the Road Accident Fund, which is quite a significant levy, we've got serious, this will have serious consequences for the ordinary citizen. It comes at a time when inflation is starting to rise. It will, without a doubt, have a negative impact. The increase of petrol price will be felt in all spheres of the economy, and it will have a direct impact on all South Africans. And it's most probably on your poorer South Africans that are using public transport and public services, for example, where they will be paying more for bus services, taxi services, etc., in terms of petrol and commuting to and fro work. The rich don't commute so often. It's the poor that need to commute to get to the work, and it's workers that pay the brunt there. Regarding sin taxes, it's been a pattern over the last number of years to increase the sin taxes. Our concern from producer side is specifically with the agricultural sector, the wine industry. The wine industry has taken a bit of a slack over the last couple of years with increased competition from international perspective and having to ensure that they're competitive. What is the impact on that? Our concern remains with the workers, agricultural workers, that become redundant when there are increased taxes on the employers and people in that industry, so that's our concern. Gambling tax, very welcome. In terms of the tolling of roads and the e-toll system implementation, this system will first kick in Gauteng. Motors are already under pressure, and the prospect of sizable petrol price increases in the coming months could have a crippling effect on the workers of South Africa. A lot of the people who use these toll roads to commute daily are not the highest income people. A lot of they are your lower workers and workers that need to commute. They're commuting between the higher income earners or higher income areas where the work is. They're commuting between the northern part of Johannesburg, the East Rand, and from Pretoria. So a slightly lower income motorist will often live out in these areas. Because their properties are cheaper, it's going to pay the brunt of the e-tolling system. Even though it's capped, it's still going to have a major impact. We would have believed in a much more phased-in approach over a good number of years rather than the sudden shock of increase, quite dramatically as it's going to take place. Producers therefore filed our Section 70 protest action at NEDLAC to deliberate on the matter, and the matter is within the domain of the committee dealing with the Section 70 and NEDLAC and government in that action. We have the view that Cabinet does have the legal mandate to make decisions regarding the policy and the final price that consumer must pay. However, the final price in the setting of tariffs is the role of an independent regulator, and they are abusing the system. And this has been the case of electricity, pipelines, and other sectors, and that's where our concern lies. Encouraging household saving, we will see a discussion document published by May 2012 to facilitate consultation and refine the proposal. We are in agreement with this, and we've been calling for some sort of measure to ensure that there's savings on that. National health insurance, I'm just going to state that producers concerned about the lack of consultation on the NHI process between the Department of Health and the relevant stakeholders. The budget review contains no new information regarding the NHI funding. I've heard that the FSC said that they are looking at the funding models and it will come out. However, funding models need to be discussed with the stakeholders because it's our money in pension funds and retirement funds that might be used for some of those funding models, and therefore it is a concern to workers. The funding model seems to be that it will be an increase in VAT, payroll taxes, employer or additional taxes on individuals, and a combination of these. We believe that the matter should be subjected to thorough discussion at NEDLAC by all relevant stakeholders. We've had a presentation at NEDLAC but no opportunity to engage on it. The intention is how it will be funded is critical, because what it boils down to is some or some of the mechanism where your individuals can contribute more in total taxes to help fund the NHI. As an organization representing workers in South Africa, we would like to be part of the process to align the social funding options for national health insurance. The discussion paper will be published by end April 2012 to deal with the financing mechanisms, and we will obviously comment on this. However, we believe that the current document that's on the table, the NHI document, is merely an extension of public services, and it's not NHI in the sense that it's got a universal access to all, and we're concerned about that process. 2012 government priorities and budget votes. I'm just going to focus on a couple of votes. I'm going to hand over to my colleague to deal with some of the social security aspects in the votes there.
All right, obviously with our commitment to job creation, first I'd like to address the Community Works Program within Vote 3. Fiducia appreciates the commitment to the expansion of this program with a $3.5 billion additional allocation. We see it as an innovative solution to temporarily curbing unemployment while providing essential social development services. On top of this, we see it as engaging citizens, encouraging ownership, and community mobilization. However, much like the Expanded Public Works Program, we caution against the program becoming a charity case rather than developing individuals in the workplace. Government should ensure that there's a measurable transfer of employable skills and opportunity to engage in meaningful employment. We also suggest perhaps extending the program from an interim solution to a step on a career path into more permanent, meaningful employment, therefore maximizing on the work-based training for those involved. Within the Vote 8 on women, children, and people with disabilities, and in the Program for Women Empowerment and Gender Equality, we see that the Commission for Gender Equality received 65% of the department's budget. We acknowledge their performance in the last period with the completion of a significant number of reviews of policy, complaints dealt with, and awareness campaigns in 2011-2012, which has been attributed by the Commission to investment in human capital development. We are concerned, however, about the high number of vacancies in this commission that was recorded at the end of 2011, and with the transferal of knowledge and consistency in delivery. And elsewhere in the Women and Empowerment Program, we're pleased to note that one of their core objectives is to adapt international and regional instruments on women empowerment and gender equality into existing national gender initiatives, working closely with the International Labour Organization and the International Trade Union Council. We are often involved in adapting these international instruments. We appreciate the review of the Domestic Violence Act and also government's maternity leave policy. We also appreciate the provincial consultation planned. Fiducia favors social dialogue and supports the planned provincial consultative meetings regarding both the draft bill on gender equality and rural women's development. We wish to ensure that the Labour constituency is included in these consultations going forward. With regard to children's rights and responsibilities, we appreciate similar plans to lead consultation with other departments regarding the training of officials in mainstreaming children's considerations. And likewise, with regard to the program on rights of people with disabilities, we encourage these public-private partnerships that are being investigated with regards to both the coordinated intervention model to improve quality of education at special schools and also the integrated support model to increase access to institutions of higher learning. Fiducia encourages engagement and collaboration with the Department for Higher Education and Training, who have dealt with some of these issues in their green paper on post-school education and training. We also appreciate the review of the Expanded Public Works Program to increase participation of those with disabilities, but again ask the question, will their incorporation lead to sustainable, measurable skills acquisition and relevant career paths, or merely compensation for unskilled labour? And again, we support the development of a model outlining norms and standards for mainstreaming disability considerations into skills development centres, so as to enable equal opportunity to contributing to our economy. With regards to higher education and training, Fiducia has adopted a resolution to lobby with government to incentivize universities to produce enough appropriately skilled and qualified people central to the needs of the industry and the economy. Our resolution recommended a differentiated government subsidy system where courses delivering scarce skills were made inexpensive and those delivering skills in abundance were made more expensive. Fiducia therefore notes government's enrollment planning exercise to be conducted at all universities to expand enrollment in key scarce skills such as health sciences, education, and technology. And again, the final year loans program is encouraged by Fiducia. With regards to the skills development program, it is stated that it aims at increasing numbers of artisan learners registered from 30,000 to 33,000. Fiducia does not believe that 3,000 learners is an adequate increased target considering the skills shortage that the country faces. We want to ask the question, what can be done to increase this target? And then obviously with the sizable amount of the budget allocated to social assistance, Fiducia has a few concerns. Firstly, we are concerned with the growing number of grant recipients that are annually that is recorded, and further concern that in proceeding like this way that we're going to become a welfare state. And there's a growing rate of dependency where money just handed out will not lift our poorest out of poverty. Producer suggests constructive research into a conditional cash transfer system, which is employed in other world economies such as the Bolsa Familia in Brazil, and other social enterprise solutions. Producer does appreciate the 11.4% reduction in disability grant beneficiaries due to the improved assessment process, and similar process regarding foster care and old age grants would be appreciated and encouraged. Similarly, Producer welcomes the implementation of the Inspectorate of Social Security as a vehicle to monitor and oversee grant payments. We are also pleased in terms of social welfare to note the commitment to early childhood development and the ISABINDI program. With a lot of research being undertaken at the moment, early childhood development has been recognized as critical to the later years in education. However, there is a concern regarding the auditing process they want to go through and the heightened registration standards, particularly at the moment in the Cape Town metropolitan, early childhood development centers are being shut down or discouraged because they don't reach the heightened registration standards. We're leaving a lot of children out of childcare and a lot of teachers without jobs. We see that 24.4 million rand has been allocated to audit all ECD centres across the country, and we suggest that thought is given to interim solutions for providing services to the children while upgrading services and teacher qualifications. Mismanagement can lead to many women left jobless and children left without daycare services, whatever the level, as is the case in the Cape Town metropolitan. The ISABINDI program, Fiducia welcomes this as another innovative program that yet again combines alleviation of unemployment with the provision of social services. More interventions such as these are encouraged if we are to make a substantial difference in the triple challenge of poverty, inequality, and unemployment.
Public service and administration both, we would like to raise our concern as an employer abuses the budget speech to commence with collective bargaining. We've seen this over the last couple of years. The fact that 5% have been laid down as an absolute figure almost obviates the need for collective bargaining. The matter was raised with the Minister of DPSA during bilaterals at the end of 2011, and an undertaking was given to address the issue. It's our contention that it does not bode well for collective bargaining. If the first salvo is on the public domain, we trust that collective bargaining for this year won't once again be out in the media. It's really concerning to us as an umbrella organisation representing affiliates within the public sector. Treasury is acutely aware of the need, the terms of a PSCBC Collective Agreement 1 of 2011. There's numerous uncompleted processes regarding funding. It seems as if departments are doing the agreement in silos and not consulting Treasury as such. The NHR is to be implemented, and a quality service-orientated public health system is supported by all. But the perception is that the right of employees with regard to an employer subsidy may be sacrificed. It's extremely sensitive within the public service, and we need to address this matter and require some more clarity from Treasury in this regard. We expect a protracted period of collective bargaining based on the fact that the process commences with the perception amongst organised labour that the employer has already decided they're not preparing in good, safe bargaining, and it's a concern to us. In light of this, recent decisions of the International Labour Organization Committee on Freedom of Association regarding public sector wage negotiations stated that the government runs the risk that producer might go to the IGC to report the violation of collective bargaining to the ILO if it continues in this fashion. We have viewed that the Constitution's principle must not be sacrificed, and we propose that the system and wisdom of the ILO and be used in the PSCBC, for example, to develop a fair framework for negotiations in the public sector in line with Treasury's requirements. The ILO is expert in this field to provide support for government as the employer and organised labour, and we need to deal with it. One of the aspects in the budget, the Minister's speech, for example, was the filling of vacant posts. Very concerning to us because the PSCBC has, on the 5th of July 2007, signed the PSCBC Resolution 1 of 2007 that specifically deals with the issue of vacant funded vacant posts. The issue of vacant posts plays a burden, and it is very clear that some of the government departments are not dealing with agreements and policy processes that need to be followed. In terms of the reducing of the wage bill, it's unfortunate that there's only that the focus is always on the public service when we've got to reduce the bill. I've heard in earlier speakers talking about the benefits of ministers, and in the same light, we would also like to see there's various benefits. You walk around the corridors of Parliament, and you see a lot of water being given out. You see snacks, etc. One needs to look at that, because are we wasting money at the end of the day? So I don't want to poke a finger to parliamentarians, but I think we need to note it, because these are the issues that our members on the floor are facing to us, and we need to address that.
We've prepared that for you.
Then we will. We are aware of the sensitive needs of the country, and when we do our wage demands, we deal with issues such as job losses, poverty, unemployment and inequality. There's a focus on inflation forecast, what the impact would be on the salaries working in the public sector, as well as CPI. These outstanding matters are ones that could be used to mitigate against a higher wage percentage increase. But it is concerning that we can't have some of these agreements implemented, and we keep on extending agreements, and it's a major concern to us. Vote of Labour, I think there we just would like to say that there's a lot of things, there seems to be a concern that once again the department is working in silos, and some of the programs and priorities are not talking to each other, specifically in the inspectorate and the labour relations sector. We also seem to note with concern that NEDLAC seems to be the ugly stepsister. NEDLAC plays an important role in the broader society, given the requirements of NEDLAC Act, and a strengthened NEDLAC may assist in faster and better outcomes. In conclusion, the budget contains a lot of information. It's only possible to comment on a few aspects. We are not economists. We are merely political scientists and workers out there that are trying to focus on the key areas that our workers out there feel we should be addressing. Over the next couple of weeks, we'll be making various submissions on specific budgets dealing with specific issues within the budget domain. Producer's most important aspect is probably the incorporation of the report of the National Planning Commission and the reprioritizing of expenditure towards infrastructure. We also feel more comfortable with the direction that the Minister of Finance is taking in steering public finance towards a more sustainable basis. We would like to thank the Portfolio Committee for this opportunity to share our thoughts on Budget 2012. Thank you.
Thank you. We're just consulting with my co-chair here. As our great honorable members that will take these presentations, all of them simultaneously, and do the discussions at the same time. The next presentation is by PwC. Prof. Whilst you're still preparing the last two presenters, you can serve yourself with the food outside. Come back and join us. I can see you thinking sharp now.
Shall I proceed? Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. My discussion today is going to be very brief, as always is the case at this stage. I hope most people will be appreciative of that after you've had a very long 2 days. It'll be brief for two reasons. I'm going to focus mainly on the tax proposal that is our focus at PwC. I'm going to talk mainly about the tax proposals, or only about the tax proposals. And the other point, of course, the other reason I'm going to be relatively brief is you will get to hear from us in a lot more detail later in the year, as, again, lots of members will know. The tax landscape just necessarily is like that. We only really know what we have concerns about or what we support once we see the actual detail, and we always use that phrase, the devil's in the detail. I'm going to talk about... I'm going to present this discussion under those three topics over there. The first point is just we see a continuation. I don't think it's cause for concern of the trend over the last few years that the bulk of tax revenue comes from individuals, from mortals. Personal income tax increasing proportionately compared to the other taxes. And if I can just use slightly just a different comparison. Most corporates will say that these days the biggest component of their profits goes in salaries, and that's clearly coming through in the bulk of tax take coming in the form of personal income tax. For individuals and for business, I'd like to talk about two separate aspects. The issues that we welcome and that we think need to be encouraged, and some of the things that we are concerned about, and we look forward to some of the details on that. The first point that we wish to encourage and that we support is the simplification of the retirement contributions regime. At the moment, technically, it's very complex, and some stuff counts, some doesn't count. Provident funds are left out in the cold. So contributions generally to retirement funds, the simplification, I'm going to be contradicting myself in a few minutes, but for the time being, the first point I'd like to make is that we support that. The introduction or the development of a new savings mechanism, we'll wait for the detail on that again. We will wait for the detail, but the point here is conceptually, we support this as an appropriate way to go. And then the increase in the CGT threshold is another point that we support. Our concerns from the perspective of individuals are as follows. First of all, the redistribution of wealth through the tax system is something I think we accept as the way things are, and I think it's for most people accept it as an appropriate mechanism. But we have to start asking the question of when are things starting to creak and starting to get close to buckling under the pressure. Last year, for example, before we talk about last year, we know that for the past decade and a half, SARS has been lauded appropriately for being able to increase the tax base. So not increasing the tax collection from one single group, but bringing more and more people into the tax net. That process, we're starting to concern now, is that coming to an end? Is it stumbling? We had, for example, last year proposals to employ more youth. So the youth unemployment and the proposed youth employment subsidy that was proposed last year, we suddenly haven't heard anything about that anymore. So that whole increasing of the tax base issue is something that we're starting to be concerned about. If you look at personal income tax, for example, you have 4.5% of South Africans, of individuals, contributing to almost 40% of the total tax collection from individuals. Now, yes, I mean, we can say that that's the majority of high-income earners, and redistribution of wealth is appropriate. But it's climbing. It's constantly climbing, and we're starting to rely more and more on a smaller sector of taxpayers. Earlier on, I said retirement and some of the reforms we welcome. savings, on the question of savings, we have to ask the question, are we sending mixed messages here? There's a whole lot of talk about increasing and encouraging savings. There are several proposals in the last year's and especially this year's budget proposals that actually discourage savings. For example, prescribing to savers how they should save. At the moment, we have an interest exemption which effectively sends a message that if you put your money in the bank and you just leave it there, then you know the interest up until a point will be exempt. Now, removing that means we want you to save, but we actually want to tell you how you can save and how you can't save. Similarly, contributions to retirement funds is, again, earlier on I said the contributions regime, we welcome the simplification, but why cap it? Why say, look, we want you to save, but up until a point, and beyond that, we're not going to give you tax relief. Dividends tax being increased, I'm going to talk about this a little bit later as well. The sudden increase in the dividends tax rate, again, how do people spend their savings? Where do they store their savings? Is it in Kruger Rand? Is it in equities? Again, the increase in the dividends tax rate means this makes this slightly less attractive. And, of course, the increase in the capital gains tax rate or the inclusion rate, again, is a disincentive to storing your wealth. The medical credit regime overall is something that we welcome, but I want to make the point here actually relates to the first aspect there as well. When middle and income and higher income earners feel like they are being effectively hit twice, and I'll just talk a little bit about what precisely I'm referring to here. In the current regime and the process going forward, the threshold for getting relief for medical expenses will be 7.5% of your taxable income. And what that means is the more you earn, the less relief you get. That's already built into the system, that's the way it works, and that's what people accept. Now, the more you earn, the less relief you get means that for higher income earners, there's less relief. The conversion to the medical credit system actually then exacerbates that problem, which means that there's a double disadvantage for middle and high income earners. Turning now to business. There's a huge amount of stuff that we welcome. Although we would kind of still complain that there's not sufficient incentive for entrepreneurship and small businesses, we welcome the fact that steps are being taken, and every year there are bits in additional measures. Proposal to look more closely at the introduction of special economic zones to encourage investment is also something that we laud. Quite a big deal is the ability to deduct interest for share acquisitions. Again, we'll see, I mean, it comes with a fair deal of complexity and there's going to be a lot of restrictions attached to it, but conceptually it's something that we welcome. Lowering of the company tax rate for the tax rate on foreign companies, so the foreign companies we established their branches over here, is entirely appropriate because dividend tax now effectively moves to the shareholder. And then the assistance effectively to South Africans investing abroad. There's been running battles with SARS on what do you do if you fund your foreign subsidiaries using interest-free loans. Is that a bad thing? And Treasury are coming around and saying, look, this is the way we support our outward expansion. So we welcome that as well. And then the projects that have been put on the table, areas of complexity that we welcome, areas of complexity that are going to be looked at and that are hopefully going to be simplified or at least addressed. The taxation of financial instruments, especially foreign exchange instruments, and also the treatment of property loan stock companies. Again, we don't know what the detail is, but the fact that that's on the table and that there's recognition that these areas need to be addressed are aspects that we welcome. Some of our concerns, withholding tax rates on interest and royalties are proposed to be increased to 15%. I've got it under the heading of concerns. I don't think it's really such a big deal. It's more of a question of why. It's not really going to result in significant revenue collection. In terms of South Africa's myriad of almost 80 double tax agreements, there's very little tax for us to collect there. I don't know why we're going there, but so that's our concern there. The sudden changes to the dividends tax regime is cause for concern. I must say the actual rate of 15%, I want to put this on record that we don't have concerns about the rate of 15%. Internationally, a withholding tax on something like dividends, you will see it anywhere between 5% and 30%. So 15% is not really a big deal. I think the two concerns for us are more like this. Number one, the whole, in terms of our credibility and just certainty coming out of this country, how do our foreign investors look at us? Because we've been saying since 2007, the announcement was made that we're going to get the dividends tax, and the dividends tax will come in at 10%. And then in 2007, as part of the announcement, it was said, the expectation in that announcement was we will get the dividends tax in maybe 2008 or 2009. And then in 2008, we said in 2009 or 2010, but it's going to be 10%. And then there was silence, but it's going to be 10%. And all the way through the entire process, it was 10%. And people were saying, okay, eventually South Africa is going to have certainty in the 2011 budget speech. Now it's almost 4 years later after the original announcement. We had the statement, okay, we're drawing a line in the sand. It's going to be 1 April 2012, and it's going to be 10%. And then on the eve of the introduction, we have the increase to 15%. And again, I don't have a problem with the 15%, but the way that this is being done, it doesn't engender certainty, and if we want to remain competitive, that's one of the requirements that foreign investors look for in an investment destination. Do those guys make sudden funny movements, or is it relatively stable? So we're a little bit concerned about that. The other thing, I suppose it's a slightly technical point, is that we're actually forcing SARS to operate illegally now for the next few months, because the legislated rate come 1 April 2012, that Parliament has passed, is 10%, and the actual promulgation of the increase to 15% is going to happen when? Maybe October, November, or January or February next year. So for the entire period now, from 1 April, we're actually going to legally have a rate of 10%, and SARS is going to be forced to tell companies, sorry, we just have to take 15%, because that's kind of what the announcements were. So that kind of strain could have been avoided if we just took a phased approach. We said, okay, well, we'll do this next year. We're giving you guys enough time. You know, there's no sudden movements here. The specifics on this proposal, we don't know, so I suppose this is just a matter that we're concerned about. What exactly does Treasury mean that when it says that all income, all passive income as well as all gains must be taxed at the same rate or treated equally? This is not a kind of internationally or South African concept understood in South Africa or even accepted that if you earn rental income on a building and if you earn interest income on your cash or dividend income, or if you just buy an asset and hold on to it for a long time and then have a gain, that all of those things will be taxed at 40%. Is that what is intended here? So we don't know what is intended. We don't know where they're going. But we are flagging that as something that we are concerned about for the future. The carbon tax is something that is some particular area of concern for us, because it seems to have been moved beyond the debate, kind of just very silently, beyond the debate of whether or not there should be a carbon tax. The expectation now is that there will be another consultative paper later in the year, but the discussion is going to be how do we implement the carbon tax, not the question of whether there should be. And we don't know how we got to suddenly moved to this stage where this is the only intervention that is possible. I mean, let's just keep in mind that 50% of the carbon tax that will be collected here will be from Eskom. And there's nothing that they can do about it. They are dependent on coal. There's absolutely nothing they can do about it. That is the reality of the situation. So that just has to be passed on to consumers anyway in the electricity price. That is just one point. So we are concerned. I mean, we are happy that the things are not moving very quickly and that there is going to be a consultation paper. But the question is, should the consultation paper be about how to implement the carbon tax, or should it be a step back on whether or not there should be a carbon tax? Our last point is actually a repeat from last year, slightly different slant, but a repeat of I'm concerned about National Treasury and the legislative drafting team over there. Members will know that we spend a lot of time in contact with them. But we are hugely concerned about the resource constraint and the amount of things that are being taken on. And I must say, 2011, the bill that was promulgated as an act in January 2012 must stand out as one of the most horrific bills in the history of tax legislation in this country in terms of mistakes, anomalies, things that just don't work because of the huge complexity of the stuff that's being taken on and without a period of consolidation, a period of just, you know, breathing. This year, the South African Income Tax Act turns 50, having been originally promulgated in 1962, and it is really falling apart. The rewrite project that was initiated by National Treasury some 5 years ago has progressed incredibly slowly, and our point here is that if we keep coming up with more and more complex legislation and doing all this patchwork, adding it on, bolting on more bits and pieces without giving anyone breathing space and time to consolidate and understand what is already there, we're going to end up with something that in fact is already becoming very unmanageable. And one of the results of that as well is that important policy issues, things like group taxation and various other things, are not, there's no space for that on the agenda because of the resource constraints. So the final point I wanted to make is that this is kind of a call from us, the tax practitioners and taxpayers. This is us putting our hands up breathlessly and saying, please, can we have a break, while everyone kind of like gets up to speed on where we are. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Prof. We will engage with your submission later on. As always, it's very stimulating. Can we have a Saipa? Etienne? You too, Prof. If you feel like stretching your legs, we're provided a good somewhere is outside. You know, we don't want to stuff our visitors. Okay.
Afternoon. Just give a bit of background. South African Institute of Professional Accountants is a professional accounting organization, which is also a member of the International Federation of Accountants. The Institute has an excess of 7,200 practicing members and professionals, with about 2,800 learners and associates. We also represent approximately 25% of registered tax practitioners. Those would be the compliant tax practitioners, not the ones the Minister referred to. We also have our members practice predominantly in the small, medium-sized practices. There's some public sector, and then, of course, in commerce and industry. The organizations, the majority of their clients is the SMME sector as well as individuals. So instead of addressing many of the issues that you would have heard today and yesterday, we want to focus our commentary predominantly related to our member base and the clients that they would represent, being predominantly small businesses and individuals. Now, as a general, we're quite pleased with the budget. We understand it was a very difficult budget at times like this to balance it, because at the end of the day, you have greater demands for spending than the money that you can collect. At the same time, we also recognize the reduced deficit from what was expected, because if we had to pan back about 6 months and we started looking at those numbers coming up to the midterm budget last year, October, I would have predicted a far greater deficit. So we're quite pleased with the lower deficit, because ultimately it means that it's less debt for us to repay later. Of course, the proposed infrastructural development, we are very excited about it because we firmly believe that business needs infrastructure, and infrastructure and business is where the future of sustainable employment and economic growth will come from. The voluntary savings and interest part of the announcement, to a great extent, we're not in disagreement with the concept of creating a tax-free environment for saving. In fact, we encourage it, but we have certain concerns. And just like previous presentations, you've heard that there's concerns there too. Now, our concerns are very similar in line of you changing the nature of how things work. And predominantly, when you look at interest earnings, the tax-free part of it did stimulate that people put money into the bank and various mechanisms that had interest earning or interest returns. And in line, majority of those interest returns would be essentially with banks. Now, the reality is that banks use your money to, well, give it out to others who need money, who need to borrow in turn. So if we changing the function of giving an interest exemption, and we're changing the model of saying that we want to have only a tax incentive for the lower end of the scales and not at the top end, all we're doing is we're encouraging the persons at that end to possibly look at alternative vehicles to invest their money, and possibly we could see that banks would find it more difficult to capitalize the borrowing needs that they would have for their clients later on. So that's one concern that we have. The other concern that we have with this is that we still in South Africa have ultimately a, first of all, a need for a cultural and an educational change relating to savings, because the predominant mentality out there is that savings is not something that I could do now, well, I'll do it later. And it's true that we start saving far too late for retirement because we have this culture. You add to that the vast number of unemployment that we have, availability of disposable income for the middle to low income families, the security of those funds, what kind of returns are expected, because if this is not government funded returns, this is investment funded returns, you just don't want to tax it. But ultimately, investment return, if it's not a good investment return that can beat inflation, there's no incentive to put your money there in the first place. So all of these things, we're concerned that just giving a tax saving is not going to instill or encourage people to start saving. It takes far more than that. It's a cultural and educational change that we'll need to drive that. For small business corporations, I can say it in the easiest way to say it is that we were delighted with the revised tax table with the reduced tax rate for small business corporations. We were also very excited about the announcement of micro businesses only having to file biannual returns. We, of course, know from a SARS point of view, it might be a little bit more difficult practically to implement, and there might be some delay in doing so. But ultimately, we support that, and we think it's a great initiative. We do, however, have a very big concern, is that we still think of small businesses as being manufacturing or retail. Because the reality is a small business corporation and the micro business provisions that we have essentially exclude personal services. So any person who applies his mind, skill, knowledge, experience, just right down to general consultation, essentially is excluded from any of these tax incentives. And we've repeatedly said, well, what are we trying to do? The reality is that small businesses is the greatest growth element in economies worldwide. And if we had to break that down, service industries in that environment makes up the majority of that. And the reality is why? Because it's easier to start, it needs less startup capital, less capital keep on running. Your margins essentially are far greater because it's not dependent on a stock turnover or manufacturing. You're less volatile to a number of economic factors. Your capital needs are far less. So essentially, you find that our prediction is that small to medium-sized businesses in service-based business is going to be a key part of the economic growth of the country. And essentially, employment of people. It's that same environment where the learners go. It's the same environment where employable skills get developed. You don't have to do it at large scale to make a big difference. If you have enough small businesses, each with one or two learners, you are making a massive difference to the skills in this country. So we are asking that addition to what was announced in the budget, that consideration be given that while we're being so generous with the tax rates for small businesses, small business corporations, that the provision of personal services that's excluded there be revised. And we understand that the 14 million threshold for the qualifying criteria there is quite high when we start comparing it to service, because you don't have the overheads and cost of sales and manufacturing costs that you typically would have then. So our proposal would be, if you do that and you're concerned with the abusive nature, being that you want to limit this to small businesses, we're proposing that we would like to see that personal services are allowed to participate in this concession, but perhaps at 50% of the annual threshold rate. In other words, a threshold limit of 7 million to cap it at. And that would have a significant difference to stimulating small businesses in future. With regards to capital gains, we're not opposed to the change of the inclusionary rate. What we are concerned with is the notice period that was given. We must realize that capital gains essentially ties back, to capital. And capital, to a great extent, either is part of investment or, when you dispose of it, gets reinvested. So people's planning, the whole process, anything that they do related to these capital items is affected quite literally a few days' notice that this is changing. So we would have liked to have seen that, as we've seen in the past budgets, that the habit has become where we're giving you a year head up to say, this is going to happen next year, or this is what we're planning on doing. We would have liked to have seen a phasing approach rather than here it is on your doorstep 1 March. At the same time, we're also saying that in previous budget, it was announced that, or admitted by the Minister of Finance, that estate duties is in fact a very ineffective and inefficient tax to collect. In fact, if you look at the based on the reporting that has been done over the last year, if we looked at the period from 2008 through to 2010, estate duties generated a mere 0.12% of total tax collected for a period 2008 right through to 2010. That's an insignificant value of collection considering the cost of tax. And ultimately, estate duties generally yield a double taxing effect when you compound it with capital gains tax. So we're asking, because since the last announcement, it's gone muted in the discussion of estate duty, we're asking that this be brought back into the discussion, that since we're increasing the rate of inclusion of capital gains, which obviously now starts negating the need for an estate duty, we're asking that it be seriously considered that estate duty be scrapped with the simultaneously with the increase of the inclusion rate of capital gains tax. With regards to provisional tax, there are many issues, and it's been raised in various forums, at Treasury, national stakeholders, with SARS, various elements of issues that pertain to provisional tax. One of the issues that we'd like to raise here, and we're asking for you to please seriously consider this, because it seems to be one of those things that we'll maybe deal with it in years to come. And it actually creates a very inequitable tax system. Because what happens is, with provisional tax, you have to estimate your taxable income before year end. So you literally have to use a crystal ball, predict what your income is going to be, not how much your tax liability would be, but what your taxable income would be. Then when it comes to your assessment, after the fact, we'll compare your assessed taxable income to your prediction. And if you were out by a certain margin, we'll penalize you with a 20% underestimation tax, regardless of how much tax you actually paid and whether or not the fiscus was actually out of money, out of pocket. And we've seen many examples of where taxpayers end up getting a tax refund because they've paid more than their fair share of tax through the year, but yet they are charged an underestimation penalty because their taxable income estimation wasn't correct enough compared to the final assessed tax. Because currently our provisional tax provisions does not allow for the Commissioner of SARS to waive penalties where it's shown that the taxes paid were sufficient the penalty is based on taxable income estimation and not the physical tax quantum that is owed to the fiscus. And we're asking that that please be revised urgently. There are many other issues with provisional tax, but as an interim, we're asking that that should definitely be on the agenda as being addressed as soon as possible. With regards to the fuel levy, we have certain concerns with regards to a 100% increase compared to the prior year increases to fuel levy. And the reason why we have a problem, and I'm sure that not only the presentations here today, but yesterday's presentation said the same thing, that this increase ultimately affects inflation. And inflation affects everybody. And at the moment, we're at that point of where we are trying to manage our inflation. We just 0.1% above inflation. We're not really going to be helping our inflationary targets and trying to stay within those if we keep on adding things that will have a direct impact on inflation in the short term. We understand the need for the increase to the fuel levy, but such a significant increase in such a short time, we believe that the impact it will have on inflation and a common person in the street is far greater than the purpose, and perhaps this should be stagnated a little bit more or reduced. In conclusion, because there's many items I'm sure you have heard on and we don't want to repeat, but we take recognition of the number of parties that are involved in the planning and treasury and various people who get involved in planning and preparing for the national budget and the amount of work and effort that goes into it. And we want to say that we do appreciate it, and we believe that everyone is doing this for the best of the country. But ultimately, we have to look at the future of this country, and every little bit of these commentaries that have been made in the last 2 days, I believe, has got some significance in terms of what our economy will look like in future years. Thank you.
Honourable members, we have all the three presentations. We are not going to have any break until we finish the discussions now. Even in terms of our program, it's like that. If you are hoping that I was going to relax the rules, no. It's not going to be like that. We have taken three presentations at a go. You will indicate in terms of your questions of clarities and comments, specifically, which presentation is your question or comment referred to. Can we move? Honorable Mashile? Honorable Harris? Ndate Chani? Honorable Ross? I'm sure your tax issues have been addressed. That is why I was very less interested in participating. I'll just go and check with SARS. Thank you. Over to you in that order. The demachin.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. I really do have a series of questions, of course. I think the first one was Fedusa. I believe so. Chair, I actually just wanted to understand one thing from them, that the minister indicated the economic growth to move from 3.1% to 2.7% at the end of 2012, but then expect 4.2% moving to 2014. I just wanted to check with them whether they agree with that. And if they agree with that, what is there that convinced themselves that we will then be moving to 4.2 by 2014? Then the second question is that FFC has indicated that to sustain the economic growth, we need to create a quality education system. Now, if that is the case, if they agree with FFC, or the first thing is whether they agree with FFC that we need to create this this quality education system for the purpose of sustaining the growth. Now, if they agree with FFC, how does that talk to the 4.2% moving to 2014? Because surely when you create, when you put up this new education, qualitative education system, we cannot expect it to yield the kind of people that will need to sustain the growth within 1 year for the 2013 for us to achieve the 4.2. And the next one, I think, it's welcoming the grants during the recession. That's what Fedusa is saying, welcome the grants during the recession. Now, with our posture of a counter-cycler, how do we then rejuvenate the economy? If during the recession, then the assertion is that then we should move more funds to social security. But when we have to actually activate or rejuvenate the economy, how do they see the balance on those? Then there is this announcement that has been made that those that are 65 years old, let me say old age pensioners 65 upwards, then they will get an old age pension which is less than, by something like 25 rand from those that are 75 years older. I think that's what has been proposed. Now, I just want the producer to actually indicate whether they agree with that disparity, whether it makes any meaningful or substantial importance for those that are 60 or 60 to 75 and those from 75 upwards, then differing with 25. What's the significance of the 25, right? Is it a justifiable thing? Is it a necessary policy position to do that? Then on the dividend tax, you are complaining, I think, that whether it has been benchmarked from other countries or whatever. I just want to know now from Fedusa, is it a problem if it is our own creation and we are the first to create that specific provision on the dividend tax? Do you have a problem with that? On the e-tolling, you are talking about the gradual introduction. Now, what I'm reading from that statement is that you agree with the e-tolling. When you talk to the gradual introduction, now I want to really know over how many years for the Joburg toll roads. And then, but what happens to the toll road that will come in Durban, P.E., Nelspruit, Petersburg, Bloemfontein? And then what will be the sort of policy there? Because we should not actually put the policy matter on a piecemeal that deals with Gauteng. And when we go to the next in Cape Town, then we have to start creating a new policy altogether. Then it looks like also you say you are lobbying government to incentivize universities to produce skilled whatever. Then now, I just want to check how practical will this be in relation to the current disparities in our educational systems. When we do that, are we not going to actually push universities to actually discriminate at the level of admissions to actually get people that will comply to what they want to produce. What is your understanding? Then there is also the issue that you raised about professionalization of the inspectorate. It looks like you have got a problem with the numbers. When they talk about more inspectors, the statement you wrote is that you don't need more bodies to professionalize on the labor inspectorate. Now I just want to ask, when you are professionalizing a directorate or the inspectorate, is the organogram of that specific directorate not coming into a review if you professionalize? Because surely then you'll be looking for some sort of different skills or actually reorganizing the whole inspectorate to achieve specific objectives. Does the organogram not come into a review? Because when you do that, then it's either you may be downgrading the organogram and having less people or more people. But the complaint that you are raising, it looks like you don't want to hear about any talk on the numbers. Just professionalization, then the group that is there is the one that now must be professionalized and produce the goods. And I just want to understand whether you don't think that the organogram then will come into the picture. Then to PwC. The PIT is 35.3%. I just want to understand, are you happy about it? Do you think it is high, is less? If you think it is not, you are not happy about it, what is the level that you would like to see? What amazes me is that you complain about 4.5% of individuals paying 38%. But then this particular matter actually talks to the level of income. General workers, they must go and make noise in the bargaining council, and the rest of society then must also be putting taps on them to say, no, 10% is too much and the rest. But then you get these individuals in the form of CEOs, managing directors, and general managers who just simply give themselves increases. And some of them definitely they are earning even 10, 20 times the lowest paid in the organization. Why are you surprised when only 4.5 pays 38%? Is your complaint talking to the reality out there in terms of the salaries that people are earning? Or are you deciding just to ignore that situation? But more or less, I would say that PwC, your presentation almost advocates for the haves to have more and the have-nots to have nothing. Your presentation actually wants to divide people, you know, it's the high income people and the poor at the bottom, and the class must be distinct. That's what I'm hearing. But the question that I wanted to pose to you and it is cyber together. I'm told that you are not actually paying your taxes. I'm informed that you are not paying taxes. PwC and all those 7,000 accountants you are boasting of, cyber, that you are not paying taxes, some 260 million or what, or unpaid taxes. But when you are actually working other people's taxes, is there anything you can explain to us how that situation arises? And then with PwC, you have got a lot of complaints on the last slide. Have you ever thought about putting together a legislative proposal, amendment proposals, that people that we can look at rather than just waiting for this specific occasion and complain on those ones? Because surely at the moment we are busy with a specific process, not necessarily changing the legislation. We are busy with a particular process that we actually expect that will influence us on the current legislation that is being put in front of us. Now, with amendments of other pieces of the legislation relevant to these, and is it not possible that you can put up something, a clear document on legislative proposal that we can look at our times that we have as committees and even the other committees that are charged with the responsibilities for legislative proposals. And the last thing is the complaint about cyber. You're crying about underestimating income or turnover revenue and SARS then punishing you for the underestimate for the provisional taxes. But you guys, you are learned, and you are giving service to these companies and these individuals. And in companies, one will expect that you almost have monthly annual, monthly financial statement. You are there with calculators and computers almost every day. Why should you have why the situation should arise that there is an underestimate? Why should it arise? And then are you complaining that you want a situation where the accountants are given laissez-faire to sleep and come and wake up only a month before the end of the financial year, when you are supposed to be doing these books almost on a monthly basis, and then you should be having almost 99% correct figures at the end of each and every month? I think that's all, Chair.
Thanks. Okay. I think the second input is by Tim, Honorable Tim Harris. Will be followed by Chani, Honorable Voss.
Thanks, Chair. I have two quick questions for each in order, starting with FDUSA. Your fifth slide refers to something that needs to be drastically done to tackle unemployment, and you refer to the FDUSA proposals on youth employment. I've now gone through most of your websites and I can't find it, so if you could direct me to that document, because obviously that's one of the major questions from this budget, that the youth wage subsidy that was meant to be implemented on the 1st of April and was budgeted for is now apparently not going to be implemented. Now, I understand FDUSA does not oppose the principle of a youth wage subsidy, but would like to see it have a training-based element. But you really didn't refer to it at all in your presentation, so I'd like to hear your opinion on the fact that that date is going to be missed, and preferably a report from NEDLAC, where we hear apparently other labor unions are refusing to even discuss the policy. So if that is the case, how can the Finance Minister's commitment to adjusting the design actually take place if there is an outright refusal to debate it? Can you just tell us exactly what's going on at NEDLAC? And then right at the end, you have some comments on reducing the wage bill. Surely you must accept that the shift of expenditure recently from capital expenditure to current expenditure in the budget has been driven largely by increases in the public sector wage bill, and that certainly between 2008 and 2010, the public sector wage bill was twice the rate of inflation and has regularly over the last few years been the fastest increasing item on our budget. Do you concede those realities and welcome the commitment to shift from current expenditure to capital expenditure, which would by and large be driven by more reasonable increases in the public sector wage bill? And then PwC, the on your, I think it would be the seventh slide, the one about individual concerns related to individuals. Do you support the shifting from STC to dividend tax? I mean, that sounds like a sound principle to me. Yesterday I asked Psycho, about the 2 billion rand tax loss that's recorded with that transition. And their justification, if I understood it correctly, is that the parastatals were paying STC, but they wouldn't necessarily be paying dividends tax on the recipients of parastatals dividends, and that explains the 2 billion loss. Because I was asking them how, if we were recording a 2 billion rand tax loss with the transition, why there's such negativity around the transition. And I understand the negativity around the rate of dividends tax at 15 rather than 10. You went into it at length. But I sense that there's more discomfort from the private sector, particularly about the shift. And I'm interested in why, because ultimately the fiscus is losing out. Then there was some alarming statements you made about SARS operating illegally because the 10% rate on dividend tax is legislated. Can you point us to where that is legislated? I understood it was an expectation, but I didn't understand it was actually codified anywhere. And if that is, if what you're alleging is true, that would be quite alarming. And then lastly, to Cypher, two questions. The personal services story. As you know, as I understand it, that exemption doesn't apply if you employ, I think, three or more employees as a personal services company. Can you give us an idea of how many personal services companies achieve that target of three employees? Because that, to me, would be a very neat way of utilizing the tax breaks while still driving unemployment at levels which are not excessive for a company to employ three full-time workers. Seems to be a reasonable target in exchange for those tax breaks. So I'm interested, I see what you're saying, but I'm interested in how many small businesses are actually achieving that status through employing those three workers. And then lastly, the fuel levy. I mean, you have to understand, I think, even from our position, that the finance minister needed to find additional funds. The fuel levy, you're right about all of the downsides, but the thing is, at the end of the day, it raised 4.5 billion rand. And I don't think any of us have a major problem with the fact that the finance minister managed to bring down the deficit from a position where it was starting to look alarming. So in order to do that, he needed the money. You're suggesting the fuel tax, the fuel levy is not the place to go. Where else would you find 4.5 billion rand?
Honorable Ross, because Honorable Chan is still consulting there.
Thanks, Chair. I'll be
yes, for fate that is up. Thank you.
I think my questions were taken by my colleagues. Just a question or a remark to Fidusa. They welcome the increase in the grants for the poor. Of course, that's necessary, and we should contain the safety net. But Sanlam indicated recently that the rates in terms of social grants are leveling off, and that, in my mind, could contain the dependency level to a certain extent. Perhaps just your remarks on that. Thank you very much. And if I can just then also add the tax treatment of medical expenses, especially in the system for the 65 years and older. I think you're quite right. We do need urgent clarification in this regard. I see the implementation date is 2014, but I think in the current situation there's a lot of confusion, especially within these age groups. And what can be expected, perhaps, how can we address it in the interim?
Are you back, Honorable Chani?
Yes, Chair. Thank you very much. Now, there are a few questions here because the last number of questions have been covered. To Fedusa, I just want to check now that you being one of the participants at NetLeg, if you could share with us what are the challenges with regard to this
Youth Job Creation Fund, because it's been reported that the implementation thereof has been stalled at the level of NEDLAC where discussions are taking place. Hence, the minister could not talk about it this year. So if you could just share with us what exactly are the challenges with regard to that. Number two, again to Fedusa, there are a number of things that you are raising. Others are complaints in your document with regard to failure by the employer or the bargaining council or even the department itself in terms of implementing some of the existing agreements reached at the bargaining council. Now, I'm quite aware of a number of laws in this country that regulates the enforcement of any collective bargaining agreement. If such agreements exist, what makes it difficult for you as unions to enforce them through the courts if then the employer is refusing to implement those, as opposed to continuously lamenting about the fact that you reach agreements and all those things? I think that is one point that is worth taking up with the relevant ministry, but I would want to know, why can't you follow the enforcement route in terms of making sure that such agreements are implemented? And then the last question to Fedusa again will relate to the 5% budgeted wage increase for public servants. I'm struggling to understand in my mind, because it's not only Fedusa talking about that. Everybody else outside is talking about that, and they are raising displeasure about that fact. What is actually the problem? Is the problem the 5% as it is budgeted, or is the problem transparency? In other words, you would have found it, even if it's budgeted, but it could have been better if it is not disclosed. Hence your conclusion that it obviates the need for collective bargaining. And I'm raising that in the context of the fact that I'm sure even Fedusa and any other union and companies for that matter, as and when you prepare your budgets, there will always be a budget for wage increases, even before any consultative processes with either staff reps or unions in case of companies. And that has never been used as something that will stifle the negotiations in companies or even in unions themselves. I know in unions you will only engage with staff reps and all those things, but after the budget has been adopted through your structures in the unions, why is it a strange thing when it happens in government? Because looking back, that has been happening, and sometimes your negotiations will even go beyond the budgeted percentage, and through your innovative ideas with those representing government, you'll always find ways of getting money elsewhere to do that. Why this time around does it become a huge issue that is being tabled? So hence I want to know whether it's because you don't want government to be transparent, or you've got problem with this, because I don't see how it will obviate the need for collective bargaining. And to SAIPA, the last point raised by Honorable Mashile, in fact, I wanted you to elaborate a little bit further with regard to the tax penalties as compared to the as compared to the final taxable income, because to me I think it's more important, the point you are making, to ordinary people as opposed to those who can be able to do their calculations and understand tax, because they've got their ways of doing it. And then those who can't, who don't understand tax, they just make submissions and have to live with whatever penalties that come. Hence, I wanted you to elaborate further on that and share some more information for my better understanding of that point, because I think it's a valuable point from where I sit. Yeah, that's all from me, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. That's from my side. I think
all the three presenters and the presenters yesterday, they continue to make reference to, in fact, an appreciation to the interventions by the minister in his budget speech in relation to the SMME, small, medium enterprises, or micro and small at the same time. But what is not coming out clear for me in the presentations, I don't hear a very, almost all the presenters, it is not adequate enough to engender entrepreneur development and therefore job creation. It doesn't go too far enough. Is it a threshold in terms of the money that the minister has indicated, 2 million or 14 million? Or is it something else that you'd want to look at and make a concrete proposal? Are we, or do you sense that perhaps in dealing with entrepreneur development and job creation, as it is the case all over the world, in all emerging economies, almost 60% of job creation is in the SMME sector. Are you envisaging a situation where we can begin to say, let's look at the number of employment rather than look at the turnover, or both at the same time, so that we have a clear sense of what is it that we need to do and recommend for job creation, because that remains a serious and a sore point for the South African society, specific reference around the youth and so on and so forth. But unemployment is a serious problem. And one key area of intervention is on the small and micro enterprises level. But I don't get, I just hear it's not sufficient. What is sufficient? Or is it insufficient in the definition of small and micro enterprises in South Africa in relation to the developing economies, interventions in that area? That will help for us, if you were to, especially for myself, just to understand your views on that. We don't have the order of how you respond, but I think let's take it the way you did your presentations, mindful of the time that all of us and all of you have to make some response or give some response to the issues that are raised here. Fedusa.
Thank you, Chair. Since I got the bulk of the questions, let me start. I think the first question, Honourable Ms. Shirley, for economic growth is indicated by the Minister. Do we agree with that? And then it's going to move to 4.2% in 2014. But do you believe that the inflation rate could actually be higher? And that it could remain outside of the growth bracket of between 3 to 6% for quite some time. The reason for that is the vulnerability of the South African economy due to outside influences. If one sees what's currently happening in the European markets and the crisis in Europe, what impact it had in South Africa, one's got to look at that. Also, we need faster growth. It's been determined that we need a 6% growth rate in order to create enough jobs for the country. Now, it is of concern to us, and we've determined in a building block document that we've got that we need to look at certain things. And we believe that there are good grounds for concerns that fiscal stimuli and monetary easing will not be able to prevent the economic crisis from having the long-term effects that it currently has. Also, we believe that we've got to look at innovative ways of growing your economy. We need to, once the economy is blooming, then we are creating jobs. So it's really a very difficult question, but we believe that with inflation, we might even see a lower growth rate than expected, because long-term effects like petrol increases, levies, electricity levies, toll roads, etc., will have an impact at the end of the day in terms of inflation and your expenditure of your goods. When we move to social grants, that during recession one needs to look at your your society as a whole. One of the problems that we want to always ensure in last year's budget speech and in the MTBPS, it was very clearly indicated that during a recession you have more people being retrenched, you have more people being unemployed, you have more people being faced with harsh poverty realities than in a normal economic situation when your economy is growing. And therefore, to say that, I mean, it's a once-off extraordinary measure, for example, to ensure that you are able to give a grant to those people that are unemployed, whether it's UIF or social grants, etc., it's got to be a measure. You cannot sustain it in the long term, and we agree with that. And that's why we've said in our submission and in previous submissions that South Africa is a developmental state and not a welfare state, and we should really try and balance that. But we realize that due to the extraordinary circumstances that our economy has been faced with the recession, South African government is faced to deal in areas where there are concerns, and one of those concerns have been your unemployed, etc., and people that are poor. So you've got to look at social grants. And you've got to look at means to bolster that. Sometimes you've got to increase the grants for time being, for period. But one needs to look at the dependency rate. One of the solutions that Fiducia have been discussing with the Minister of Finance, for example, is looking at some sort of initiative where you will only get a grant if you qualify to certain things. In other words, you're a job seeker, or if you're unemployed, that you will undergo a type of a training-based skills program where you upgrade your skills. And we've got to look at that, and that is assessed on an annual basis, maybe once or twice a year, so that there are certain conditions in terms of that. We're currently having engagements with that, so I don't want to put all of those things on the table, but we are having engagements with that in terms of how grants are allocated. We also have a lot of ghost people on the grant system, but I think with the new measures by Social Services and Treasury, some of those measures are starting to go out of the process, but it is extraordinary measures. In terms of the disparity, the question in terms of the disparity, the imbalance when the pension grant is increased in terms of medical expenditure, the reality of life is, once you're 40, you're most probably fine. Once you're 50, your leg is not paining so much, you don't need to see the doctor, etc. Once you reach 60 and over that, that's when all these medical ailments start happening. You need specialized medical goods, most probably specialized medication, whether it's high blood pressure, diabetes, whatever it is. That's the time of your life when these things start really hitting the ordinary citizen at the end of the day. And therefore we're saying that one needs to look at that tax provision for that in terms of the tax allocation for medical expenses, etc. We find that a lot of the pensioners and people that are retired, for example, are taking the brunt of expenditure. They don't have a fixed income anymore, but inflation keeps going on, and they're being affected by whether it's petrol levies, electricity levies, food prices that goes up the minute your petrol goes up, for example, medical expenses that become too expensive to afford. So one needs to look at that. In terms of dividend taxes, the international experience, we're not saying that we've created something new. I think dividend tax is something that's been around quite some time. It's not just something that's just now created in South Africa. It's been around for some time. But one needs to look at countries that are experiencing the same type of economic situations, like developmental area. Are we on the same developmental state, or are we comparing ourselves to Britain or China, etc.? We need to look at those areas. That's probably a good example would be to look at the BRICS countries, to compare ourselves with BRICS countries and say, in that developmental state arena, how are we comparing with them, for example? Then question five, Honourable Mashili, is how many years to implement toll rolling? I mean, if we have our way, we won't have tolls. But the workers have to get to work, so we need to look at that. I've got no simple answer for you in that regard. I think we believe that an e-tolling system, most probably between 6 months to a year, to have it properly implemented so that you can adjust your budget and see where you can make the cut and what the total impact is. It's capped at, I'm under correction, I think it's capped at 550 per user, per road user for Gauteng at this stage. That money needs to come from somewhere. Our middle and lower income earners have to get that money somewhere. So maybe it's ways where the consumers will start clubbing together, driving together, etc. But one needs to look at that. I think between 6 months and a year would most probably be the best way of phasing it in over time. Our concern from the worker side is, however, where big tolling stations are being built. If you drive in Northcliffe in Johannesburg, you'll see there's an e-toll office being built at a huge expense. Why do we need these type of things? Because those all add up to the user charges at the end of the day being added to the user, and those are the regulators. I think our concern is more with how it's regulated and whether or not that money is actually going to improving our roads, for example. In terms of question six, Honourable Member asked a question about incentivising universities to graduate and enrolment. In terms of that, we've made quite some comments on our document that's on the website called the Building Blocks document. The Building Blocks document basically says that we are at this stage pumping our universities, students, and then there's a skills mismatch that we cannot take them up in the economy. How do we deal with that? How do we address it? I think that's our concern, to say that there's a major skills mismatch and then placing at universities. I hear your concern regarding the subsidies, etc., but the skills deficiencies and what our universities are producing is a concern, and this very concern is raised in the National Development Plan and by the National Planning Commission. We've got to look at the that deficiencies in education and training is contributing to the skills mismatch and therefore also adding to our unemployment figure, because we've got graduates coming from university but not being able to be employed. Have they studied the correct courses? Where are we applying our minds in terms of that? So we need a major consultation with the higher education institutions and the Minister of Higher Education in this regard. We've already started with discussions on that. And we need to focus on that, because universities are, there's a malfunctioning labor market in that sense that we aren't able to employ them, and we need to look at that. We believe we need dialogue. Companies must do more to create employment for younger people in order to address the youth unemployment. We've got to employ the supply of skilled workers dramatically, so we've got to look at what skills we are being presented. Universities need to produce more appropriately skilled and qualified people. We've got to look at delivering scarce skills in abundance. Currently, we're not producing scarce skills. We also need to focus on skills that are more expensive. How can we actually ensure that we are attracting people to go and study some of those areas? And we need to develop some sort of a process, temporary placement in companies or the public sector, maybe for people to work there for a period of time free of charge, but just ensuring that there's a basic stipend, for example, for fuel. I think those are all the questions. Oh, the last one was Department of Labour, Vote 8, the professionalising the inspectorate. And here we're speaking from experience. We've got labour inspectors and people monitoring in the inspectorate, but they hardly know how to complete a form. Now we want to professionalise and spend a lot of money on that when they can't do the basics right. So one's got to look at professionalising it is one thing, but do you have the right people appointed there? Do you need to look at merely just getting a lot of inspectors in there to do the work? One needs to look at holistically what is the problem. One needs to deal with the type of skills that they need to have when appointed, and not just professionalising the skill. There's a major focus in the expenditure review on professionalising the inspectors, but there's not a huge focus, for example, on monitoring and administration and looking at the current deficits within the department, how to overcome that. Honourable Harris' question regarding the youth unemployment subsidy, you'll find it under the Congress 2011 resolutions. It's part of our resolution document that was adopted. Specifically, the youth subsidy talks about a training-based subsidy. I've got the document with me, and the training-based subsidy is basically where we hope to raise the employment levels of young school levels. We believe that there needs to be some rebate for employers who implement apprenticeships and learnership programs. We're concerned that the wage subsidy would create a two-tier labour market, which could be misused by employers in terms to maximize profits. And we believe that the training-based wage subsidy should encourage and facilitate the entry of young unemployed people into the labor market. It should be applicable to unemployed graduates who lack work experience through, for example, an internship program that can be implemented. And it should only be applicable to tax-compliant companies, while a special dispensation should be developed to cater for NGOs and other tax-exempt organizations to ensure that they employ youth. So that's, in a nutshell, our youth-based subsidy. In terms of the NEDLAC process, the negotiator at NEDLAC is with me, so maybe she can just broad you, give you a very brief overview of where we are in the NEDLAC process on that.
The NEDLAC process is obviously an ongoing engagement. Department of Economic Development presented their proposal for combating youth unemployment in January this year, and following that, Labor's had a bilateral with DDD, and Treasury was also in attendance. The youth wage subsidy, in that respect, doesn't exist in a silo. It exists alongside a whole lot of other proposals that they are making around the Community Works Program, the Expanded Public Works Program. But some of the main concerns from Labor's side that have been tabled are the proposals aren't explicit in terms of budget, in terms of targets and that type of thing. So Labor's questioning and asking for further information on that regard. Like my colleague said, there's a concern about the possibility of the private sector abusing the subsidy to increase their bottom line. And also there's a concern from our side on the displacement of older workers, where people can be retrenched or let go because the employers would like to take on younger workers and gain the wage subsidy. So it's in process, the conversations, but as it stands at the NEDLAC negotiations, there is not enough information for us to actually take a decision on it. In terms of what's being proposed, hasn't been given to us in concrete form in terms of budget and targets. So we're working towards receiving more of that from EDD and then taking the negotiations forward.
Thank you. We're sorry, we'll have to cut you short. Those questions that we could not respond to verbally here, we would not mind to receive a submission just to respond on some of these in a more elaborative way. I'm just mindful of the fact that we still have got two presenters here that have to respond. And by 1:45, the bells will be ringing. And these members have got no choice. They must carry the flag and run. Yeah. Is it 3:00 today? Oh, okay. But we won't come back to you, Fedusa. Even with that amendment. Okay, good.
Thank you, Chair. I'll try not to keep you until 3:00 then. Okay. Just a couple of points. The first question regarding the 35% contribution by personal income tax and the opinion that we hold on that. And I'm not going to say it's good or bad. I think it's just a statement of the reality. I think the fact that it is the biggest contributor to South African tax collection is, I suppose it's just, I should say it's somewhat expected. We had comments earlier on about the state's increased wage bill. Most employers will tell you that the wage bill generally has increased. So it kind of follows naturally that employees' tax and contribution to tax by individuals will be on the increase. So that's kind of expected. Also, the dividends tax now is a tax mainly on individuals, on natural persons, not on companies. So there's a little bit of a shift there. It's actually a similar tax to the one that we had, but it's just moving the numbers around. It becomes part of personal income tax to a degree. So I don't have I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's a statement of the reality where we are. Having said that, the point of comparison and the question about the 4.5% of natural persons contributing to 38% of tax, and am I saying we need to be softer on rich people and the haves should have more and all of those kind of things? That's precisely not what I'm saying. And I think the fact that higher earners should pay more tax and the fact that higher earners should pay disproportionately more tax is something that everyone accepts and supports. I think that's exactly right. I think that we need to be cognizant of the fact that SARS's incredible success
over the past decade and a half has been their ability to bring more people into the SACNet, which means more people need to earn. So the fact that we are becoming more reliant on sucking more out of rich people is a testament to the fact that we're not getting enough people employed. We're not getting enough people into the tax system. So I suppose my point there was again, it's a statement of the reality, and the fact that higher income earners need to contribute disproportionately more as being appropriate and correct. My point there was we will continue with that, and we are continuing that, but on the other side of the scale, when we need, and this is my point about youth employment and all of that, when we start need to encouraging more employment into and increasing the tax base like that, we can't be looking at only one thing at a time, and we need to be concerned if we're going to be reliant on a small few. We want to be in a balanced system where we are not dependent on anyone, where we've got a sufficiently balanced portfolio, for lack of a better phrase, where tax collections are increased as a result of an increase in the number of compliant taxpayers, not as a result of getting more tax from the same small amount of taxpayers. So I'm not saying go softer on the rich at all. Certainly, on the other point regarding the tax practitioners who have outstanding taxes and things like that, my response there is going to be exactly what you would have expected it to be. It's going to be, it wasn't me. It's not me. But I think that may be... There may be a reality, and unfortunately, I can't really speak. I know there was a hype about the media's statement, and I didn't see it myself. And unfortunately, all I can do is speak for myself, and I can speak for some of my colleagues, and I can say quite categorically that I personally am up to I file on time. I'm up to date. Even my 250, 280 fellow PwC partners. The senior partners within the firm, when they crack the whip, I mean, this is an internal thing I'm talking about, but I mean, that is something that happens annually where we need to confirm and ensure that our tax affairs are up to date, we file on time, we pay our taxes on time, and all of those kind of things. It's kind of part of the way that we operate, but I'm speaking only for me and some of the colleagues that I operate with. And I'm sure the representative here from Cycle will confirm the process that they have internally as well. I think that we can't deny the fact that there definitely are tax practitioners out there who are, I don't know, in the technical term we use in the industry, are cowboys. So you're gonna have those people out there. And SARS themselves have initiated the process of regulation of tax practitioners. It's gone a bit on the back burner for the time being because they were busy with other stuff last year, the Tax Administration Bill. But the regulation of tax practitioners is something that we support, where precisely this, where ethically tax practitioners can be regulated and brought onto some kind of system. Okay. The next point relates to my. I suppose the phrase was used, complaints about the legislative drafting, and I think the question was, to what extent do we contribute to the development of the legislation? And I mean, I think we, from a PwC perspective, certainly would be quite happy to make proposals to this chamber, but insofar as direct relationships with National Treasury, that goes on an ongoing basis. So in terms of making proposals, offering assistance, actually even... and National Treasury are really forthcoming in setting up workshops so that they can understand what we want. I think my point there was that their workload is huge, and they are not getting to everything that they could be, and it's difficult for them to prioritize. So it wasn't a matter of us sitting on the side saying, you guys are doing this all wrong, and we're not contributing. And I actually would, without sending any emails to anyone, I actually would suggest that if anyone here were to ask... someone like Keith Engel from National Treasury to list you the top five individuals by name that contributes to discussion and constructively with him, then I'm being a little bit I've got high expectations here, but I think you'll hear that my name or our name comes up in terms of trying to interact with them and support the process. But when you see that you are being supportive, but it's still there are lots of cracks because of, and this was really my main point, because of lack of resources and the workload at National Treasury, that was really the point that we were making. The next question that I have here on my list was the shift from SDC to the dividend tax. I didn't hear exactly what was said yesterday, but certainly from our perspective, we don't have any complaints about this. This is really international best practice. With respect to the comment made by Fedusa, I don't know if it's going to be that useful to do a comparison with the BRICS countries, because this thing's all over the place. The international norm is a really difficult thing. I can tell you that, for example, the US has a withholding tax of 30%, the UK has a withholding tax of 0%. And if we are going to try and compare ourselves to the BRICS countries, it's going to be about a bit like we're looking to them, they're looking to us, and, you know, what are you doing? I'm looking over your shoulder. It's a little bit, this is a very hard kind of benchmarking process to go. But certainly, I think most of us are comfortable that we are probably in the right space. The expected loss to the fisc is lessened by the increase to 15%. But National Treasury expected this, and certainly in the announcements in 2007 and 2008. Overall, the burden on the taxpayer here is a lot less. I mean, for example, whereas dividends to pension funds in the past, or up until the end of March 2012, would be subject to SDC from the paying companies, now those dividends are all completely exempt from the dividends tax. So I'm actually surprised that we're only losing out by $2 billion. I expect it to be slightly more. And then just the last point, my second last point, there was a question about the illegality of the 15% rate, and the reference is, it's section 64E of the Income Tax Act. It comes into effect on the 1st of April. I hope everyone can see that. Okay, 64E1 makes it quite clear. It's legislated at 10%. This is what comes into effect on the 1st of April. It's not a big deal. I mean, like, they'll change it, but the change will happen. Most of us will know that we're going to have the draft bill. We're going to have me sitting here again, and we'll be fighting the National Treasury, and we'll have the debate. And eventually, when it gets legislated, I don't think anyone's going to complain about the 15%. And I'm certainly not going to be encouraging taxpayers to say to companies, you can't give me 85, you must give me 90 because the rate is 10%. But this question has been raised, that this is what SARS is now being forced to do, that this House and National Assembly have legislated a piece of legislation which says 10%, and that is what's going to be on the statute books come 1 April 2012, but they will be applying 15% is our expectation. And then just the last thing, the question that the chair raised about is enough regarding small business and all of that. And I'm afraid on this particular point, I'm going to be like one of those people who can say, I'm not sure that this is enough. But if you ask me what the answer is, I'm going to say, I don't really know. But actually, I think the point is from a tax perspective. If I speak purely from a tax perspective, I actually think we're nearly there. There are a couple of tweaks that are needed, and I certainly support the point that the FIFO representative made about services, provision of services, that its exclusion is problematic, and we can go a lot further. But I think there needs to be recognition that tax is a limited instrument. So you can encourage some stuff by reducing tax rates and by making things easier up until a point. But there are other interventions that are outside of certainly my experience, my expertise, that are non-tax interventions, like we had the point that Fedusa made about ensuring that the right skills are put out there. I mean, so encouragements like that, where you actually have things like apprenticeships, ensuring that universities churn out the right qualifications, so that we have people and the skills to encourage this kind of entrepreneurship. But if you were to ask me the question about tax interventions, I think there's very little further that I need to advocate. National Treasury does need to be doing more, but not in the tax space. So there are a few points, and I'll end there. Thanks.
First of all, one of the questions was regarding to provisional tax and why would estimations be so incorrect. Well, the reality is that you are asked to estimate your taxable income before year end. Now, if you deal with a small company, you've got limited resources, so it's difficult to just keep everything 100% up to date and having all that expertise there. You deal with a big company, you're dealing with complexities such as accounting, difference in accounting treatment, adoptions, adjustments, after year end adjustments, difference in accrual dates, revenue recognitions. You're dealing with a whole bunch of complexities and also things that only really is established at year end. So those all establish differences in the taxable income from what one would estimate. And you'll be surprised how significantly different that can be. But the reality is that our provisions currently gives a very strong penalty provision for underestimation, which effectively targets companies who in the past have utilized deliberate underestimation to defer their tax liabilities. And we're by no means attacking that. We believe that that is appropriate and it should be there. But it's the principle of while we catch and bonus people, the companies in that, the individual taxpayer and smaller businesses also fit into that. And if I take an example of an individual retiring, getting a lump sum, there's a portion that's exempt, another portion that is taxed on a variable scale. The reality is that everything that's not exempt is a taxable income. It doesn't matter when you file your provisional tax. It doesn't say, let's calculate the tax differently. It just says, what's your taxable income? The reality is that when a person gets to assessment, and through employees' tax and provisional tax and everything else, that they have paid more than their final tax liability. In other words, they are due a refund themselves. Surely you cannot expect a person to pay more than he's legally obligated to pay. In this case, the person has overpaid their tax burdens along the way. But yet, they will face a 20% penalty for underestimation because of the way the tax or the penalty is calculated with only having regard to a prediction of your taxable income to final assessed value with absolutely no regard for what the real tax, physical tax amount is that's due to fiscus and whether that was paid. And all we're asking for is essentially an add-on provision that allows for the commissioner to exercise his discretion in a case where a person can say, see here, I have paid sufficient taxes through the year, there was no deferment, the fiscus is not out of pocket, please don't waive the penalty of underestimation, because clearly that is incorrect. And it's an unfair position. In the same sense, you must understand that we have taxpayers that because of these penalties will in fact deliberately overpay their provisional tax. Now, FAS will be the first to tell you that the last thing I want to do is have to actually repay that money to you because there's an interest calculation, there's a risk on refund, there's a process of administering it. So we, in fact, on one side, encouraging people to overpay their taxes to avoid penalty, and the other side, we're penalizing people who shouldn't be penalized because, well, they didn't short pay their taxes. And all we're asking for is that needs an urgent level of attention because of its complexity it comes with. And all it is a discretionary provision that allows the commissioner to waive that penalty where it can be demonstrated that sufficient tax was paid. Where currently, that provision isn't there. You'd have to prove why you were so wrong in your estimation of your taxable income to have that penalty waived. And that's what we're asking for. The other issues of provisional tax, those still need to be addressed, but we're saying urgently is this, which is quite a very unfair position to ask a person who's overpaid their taxes to be further penalized for overpaying your taxes. Surely that shouldn't be it. With regard to personal services, you are totally correct. There is an exclusion that says that personal services, that there's an exclusion where there is three full-time, unconnected persons also involved in the core operations of their business. Now, in reality, is the majority of service businesses that you'll find will either be family businesses or start up as family businesses because you go to your immediate support structure. That's not unconnected persons. Secondly, when your business starts, you don't have the funds to employ three unconnected, qualified people to also do that. Because it can't be the receptionist. It has to be the person who does the same core function. So let's say your business is IT consultation. The people you have to employ have to be totally unconnected, full-time employed, and provide IT consultation to your clients. Now, that's part of a service business, as that kind of means to really get this off the cuff. So essentially, there's no encouragement for you to start there from a tax point. And essentially, once a business, and that's why we're saying this, we don't want the full 14 million threshold, reduce it to half that value if you'd like. The thing is that it will still stimulate startup businesses in terms of a tax position, and it taxes the cash flow position. That's a cash flow thing. And once a business has started up, it's developing skills and those things, because let's be honest, those service skills are essential skills we need. And essentially, as the business grows, there's more need for learnerships and various functions where there are tax deductions and incentives to promoters. And essentially, the business grows bigger. And outside of that tax relief, and essentially, it contributes greater to the tax fiscus. And while it stays small, it's still, whether it employs just one extra person, it's one extra person who's been employed. If it skills just one extra person, it's one extra person who's been skilled with employable skills that can be sustained thereafter. And all he's saying is by extending this so that it's not limited to the three full-time unconnected employees only, you're going to make a significant impact. And I think that ties in also to the question that was asked in terms of when is enough enough. From a tax point of view, we would say this would be what we would want. This would be the ideal structure that we're looking for, is that personal services is not so restrictive in terms of this concession. From a tax point of view, we've got enough. From there, there are other elements. We've seen some relief already in terms of the New Companies Act and various other things. But the reality is that even the smallest of business have a complexity of laws, National Credit Act, Consumer Protection Act, Promotion to Access Information Act, you name it. You do a list, there's at least 20-plus legislations that any business has to comply with. And most of the people who are entrepreneurs who start these are not highly qualified, highly legislative-skilled people with that. So there's a lot of red tape, a lot of professional advice needed, or else you risk or you face the risk of non-compliance. So I think outside of the tax position, there is certain avenues where perhaps certain relief from red tape or legislative provisions could aid. We've seen some of those fences for skills development levy of 500,000 rand and below in terms of the payroll bill a year that you exempted. Things like that. Micro-enterprises in terms of BEE compliance, in terms of automatic exemption giving you level 4 certification. That is a fantastic relief that helps those small businesses. And these are the things I think will help stimulate it. But from a tax point, for sure, the personal services of the side we would be looking for. From a fuel levy point of view, the point is well made that where will the money be replaced if we take it out there? I don't have an answer for you, and I don't think anyone here has an ideal answer how to replace that. But the reality is that the impact of a 100% increase, not a 50% increase, a 100% increase to that, will have a knock-on effect to inflation, to every person. And if you look at the pressure on future adjustments and bracket creeping to personal tax tables and the relief sought from there, seeking from there as well, we'd be inflationary obligated. So as we start hearing it, there's a knock-on effect that will keep on happening. And I don't even know what that effect would be, and I believe that if we do the numbers, we find that it might be a greater impact than the loss to the fiscus would be in the short term by perhaps having a 50% rather than a 100% increase, or maybe stagnating at 50% now, the other 50% at a later point, just pretty much helping along, especially at economic times like this. With regards to the penalties, which was raised further, I don't know if further clarity is sought, but essentially we have a number of penalty provisions, and I think that what should be borne in mind is that this year we see the implementation of the Tax Administration's Bill, which will be in, once it's promulgated as the Tax Administration's Act, it's planned to be implemented from 2012 already. It already has a significant increase in terms of from administrative penalties, non-compliance penalties, interest. There's a whole number of extra provisions that apply there, and we should take that into account as well when we think of these comments. With regards to practitioners and a comment the minister made, I think, first of all, I took personal offence being tarred with the same brush. I put a great amount of emphasis, and I know many of my colleagues put a great amount of emphasis into being a professional and acting like a professional. But that said, being compliant yourself to your tax affairs, and maybe before the record I should mention that I have nothing outstanding with my taxes. I'm one of those who file well before the deadline. and overpay my provisional tax in fear of penalties. But the reality is that not complying with your own personal tax affairs does not directly equate to your ability to help others to file their returns or to give tax advice. In fact, perhaps the common issue here is that because you know the tax law sufficiently, you know how to perhaps manipulate it. And so be it. But the reality is that SARS, since they can give us statistics to this, know exactly who the defaulters are. So why aren't they aggressively pursuing them? There are means to do it. If there's 260 million outstanding, why is judgment not sought? What's the section? Section, was it 91? 91 of the Act allows for that the Commissioner can, by issuing of a statement, address for a judgment to the court, can attach assets, can seek sequestration. Why is that not pursued? Rather, we'll publicly shame practitioners. And the reality is that a big portion of those practitioners are not associated with professional bodies. And that distinction is not made. And 18,000 outstanding returns does not equate to 18,000 poor practitioners or non-compliant practitioners. Because out of the 34,000 practitioners, you might find that a few of them have three or four outstanding returns. Because people who are non-compliant, they don't tend to be non-compliant 1 year, they do it repetitively. So 18,000 doesn't mean 18,000 non-compliant practitioners. And I think that, in all fairness, it doesn't do any good for the practitioners and the professionalism of professional bodies to kind of tar us all with the same brush. But we all know that there is, in the pipelines, regulation of tax practitioners to come, and in terms of that, we most likely will be able to address it. But in the interim, SARS has many provisions to address these issues. Why are they targeting these? They know who they are.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I think this... No, we are not going to allow for loss. I think on this last point, maybe it would be important to facilitate sort of a meeting between the practitioners and the minister or national treasury. There's a need for a truth and reconciliation commission there. It has happened and has helped national treasury to raise lots of money in terms of declarations and others, the open window. I don't know if your colleague would want to say something.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to clarify that when we are looking at tax practitioners, we have got over 60,000 tax practitioners. And out of that 60,000 tax practitioners, only about 55% belong to professional bodies. So the other 45% are unregulated individuals, men of the street that has just gone and registered as a tax practitioner. So we therefore have those that are regulated. We have very strict rules that you need to comply to a code of ethics. And those will obviously be the ones that are compliant. But unfortunately, from SARS or even the minister's pronunciation there, he didn't indicate as to whether the 18,000 are the ones that belong to or do not belong to professional organizations. And that is why we actually are taking exception to just that very broad statement being made, because it's tarnishing the entire profession, whereas it's just a few elements that are not regulated. And as professional organizations, we've been fighting for the regulation of the tax practitioners, because even the type of advice that they are giving to their clients, it's questionable. It's true that you may find that even their clients are obviously not compliant because they are not compliant themselves. But as we obviously are saying, my colleagues have been saying that it's not those that are regulated. It's mainly the ones that are not regulated. We have as an institute challenged the minister to actually name and shame. Put up a list of all those that are not compliant, and then we'll obviously take it from there. Thank you.
You won't be long, ne?
No.
Okay.
Chairperson, actually, when we ask the two gentlemen, we are not necessarily asking themselves as persons, but the sector that they are representing today when they are there. But now what we are actually talking to, the questions are there is regulated and unregulated. It is neither here or there or there. All what we are talking to the integrity and the ethics of that particular profession. We are sitting with a profession of accountants that is not complying. You don't go to the nitty-gritty and say, no, there is this one corner is complying, this other corner is not complying. We've got a profession there that's supposed to be providing that professional service. Then within it, then you've got these particular people that actually make the whole profession then to be tarnished. Then it's the responsibility of the profession to actually clean itself. That's all what I just wanted to talk here. We are not talking to the capacity and the legislation to punish. I mean, we've got all those legislation to punish you, to take them to court or whatever. But we're talking to this, the integrity of the profession. That is at stake. And it is in your hands to make sure that it is clean.
Yeah.
To actually make sure that your profession is clean, and then you must root out whatever and make all those sort of proposals and whatever within your profession. Thanks, sir.
Okay, I think they would want to say something, but let me just not paraphrase, but try to pronounce my understanding of the challenges. One is that, yes, there is a statement that challenges the integrity of this profession from the budget speech. First, from a point of self-regulating, you have to protect the sector that you are in. But in order to do so, there are certain legal requirements and frameworks that will also assist, would be required to assist, so that you can weed out what you call matulaja jinginga skwa, kwa chile. Matulaja jinginga skwa. Yeah. Yeah, backyard practitioners. You say you need some sort of assistance in that regard. Self-regulation may not be enough. It is important that some sort of a legal framework that can assist in weeding out fly-by-nights. And also, I think it is also part of the education campaign that we may need to find from your side, together with us as Parliament, to educate the public. I hope none of us as members of Parliament or public representatives, we are also subjecting ourselves to people who are not properly registered, you know, to do our taxes. Because those may be the same people who are not actually even paying their dues. So it is important that we also look into that as a challenge from the side of Parliament. So it is very, very important that we take the point that we are raising of self-regulation, but also how do we actually give the association teeth to deal with those who are demeaning the name and the character of the association itself or the profession.
I think the comments are fair, but one perspective should just be brought into it is that we haven't sat back and said, let's do nothing about it. In fact, on multiple occasions, we have encouraged SARS to report any of our members. And likewise came from SAICA and SAIT, which is the other representative professional bodies at stakeholder level, to report any member who acts in such a way to bring our profession into disrepute. Because we regard the ethics and the code that we have and the professionalism of our profession very highly. And the reality is that we cannot, in fact, tackle the big problem because the people who are unregulated do not belong to a professional body. So as a professional body, we have no authority, power, or jurisdiction to deal with those at all because they're not our members. And the reality is that at our professional level is the entry requirement of qualification and skills is so high because of the accounting element to it and review and things to cycle with audit and that, is that many of these practitioners who are unregulated do not meet the requirement to belong to necessarily one of our professional bodies.
Thank you.
No.
Bad, thank you.
Thanks.
I just want to be a little bit fair, because the response of FEDUSA were done within a particular period, and we said if there's further elaboration, they could submit in writing their responses to the questions that members have asked. Similarly, that extends to yourselves. But one of the things that I think you should appreciate and also appreciate is that your input does help us to shape the future budgets and the responses of National Treasury. It may not be adequate, you may not see the whole of it, but definitely in our report we do make sure that the issues that we have raised from the People's Budget Council, I mean People's Budget Coalition, to professional services or professional organizations like yourselves, we do seriously take your contributions very, very seriously. And I want to thank you for this important submissions that you always make to the committee. We will also try to improve on our part to make sure that we give you enough time for submissions to can reach us. As you know, you've been interacting with the money bills that governs our business in Parliament. It does put some constraints even on your part to make submissions on time. You know, the minister presented the budget today, and we almost expect in the next 5 or 10 days, in fact less than 10 days, for you people to be here to interact and come with a precise and concise proposals on what your reading is in terms of the budget itself. But it's part and parcel of the process. It's part and parcel of evolution of an institution. With those words, I would really thank you very much for being here. And honorable members, we will be meeting tomorrow. I had interacted with a number of my colleagues that to consider the draft report. Let's do that at lunchtime tomorrow, 1 o'clock. So that by the time the House sits, we should have made some few inputs into the report itself, draft report. And then we'll see the need, whether we need to meet immediately after the sitting tomorrow to finalize the report itself. So we are giving the Secretariat enough time between now, is what is the time, 12? I mean, 2? Yeah. Until tomorrow, 1 o'clock. If you can't do your work, then you are not capable of being here, of doing the job, so you don't, you can't justify your presence in the committee. So we expect you to deliver that draft report by 1 o'clock tomorrow. In fact, if you can circulate it much earlier, all the better, so that when we meet by 1 o'clock, I've gone through it. Okay? It shall be done. Agreed. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.